there was a classical tradition from Ovid that rats were creatures of putrefaction. That is, they just sort of sprang spontaneously out of dirt and mud.
Welcome to Ideas. I'm Nala Ayed. Today, an Ideas series devoted to rats.
Well, Mr. President, it's the bees and spiders again. They stole my food stamps and sold them to the rats.
Rats are almost like a gothic animal. You know, they're with us and we don't see them. We just get little glimpses of them here and there. But the reality is they're with us. They're in the crawl space underneath our house, or they're in the attic above, or they're moving through our walls.
Or occupying our imagination and nightmares.
For many hours, the immediate vicinity had been swarming with rats.
You know, one of the spookiest Edgar Allan Poe stories is about the rats in the walls.
Wild, bold, ravenous. They had devoured all but a small remnant of the contents of the dish.
By the by, have we eaten up all those old beans, Flotsam? I'm famished. Go rat about in the cupboard and see, old man.
Well, I'll give it the old army try. We've been gone, you know, probably spoiled.
Hello, what's this? This solution's turning blue. Not quite the solution I expected. That means the rat should have lived and the captain should have died, of course. Let's see. Norveticus ratus, Norveticus asses mammalia, Rodentia meridae. Ah, here we are. That's black and brown. Eats electricity.
The rat's forgotten to everything but this half tin of Uncle Sigmund's Peruvian cocoa powder.
That'll be all right.
This signaled a general rush. Forth from the well they hurried and leaped in hundreds upon my person. They writhed upon my throat. Their cold lips sought my own. Disgust swelled my bosom and chilled my heart.
Damn it and fry it. What do holes in Lake Acne have to do with the theft of my tube?
Well, there's an old Swiss saying, Mr. Acne. There? Trouve le raton, trouve le trou.
That's Canadian, sir, to find the rat.
Look for the hole, right, yes. Chief?
Ah, bulls, pizzles. You frogs don't know a hop in hell about American crime. Leave it to me and the boys in black and blue, sir. We're ready to terrorize every small shopkeeper and roust every decent citizen out of his private home.
I don't think, Chief Moriarty, that you'll find this fiend at home.
Shut up!
Take it easy, Chief.
I don't care how you do it or who does it. I want that electrician behind bars.
Well, I'm behind the bar right now. Cocktails, anyone?
I'll say.
Irish coffee for me.
Okay, just open a quick Jeroboam of champagne for everyone, Vi.
Okay, Frankie.
Coke for me, please. I understand it comes in bottles in this country.
Oh, here you are, Mr. Stone.
Oh, thank you.
Private industrial stock.
Just a moment. This drink may be doped. Oh, yes, it is. How refreshing. Did you know they once found a rat tail in one of these bottles?
Oh, disgusting.
Rat parts. Ha ha, you see, Blotsam, I played the part of the rat.
Yes, indeed, Stones, I do see.
But the twitchy-nosed goon rat officialdom triumphed.
Get your rats off in a triumph?
The rodent control board pressured us.
Rode on the running board?
And I was written out.
Driven out, oh, Stones, those vermin.
Precisely, and gentlemen, the biggest of them all eats the most electricity.
So what, Stones?
So I must follow the rat to find the cat before the rat eats the cat that's under the house that Jack built.
No offense to Edgar Allan Poe, but that was a bit overwritten. Rats rarely attack or bite humans. They prefer an existence around us, but hidden.
I think it's just that the way that they lurk about, but we don't see them. You know, we hear them, we see their droppings, and every now and then when we see one, it's a shocking encounter for both parties involved. The rats are just as terrified as we are. So it's just so fascinating the way that we're tied together by much of our own activity as human beings, yet we have this sort of repellent relationship.
From Edgar Allan Poe's 19th century tale, The Pit and the Pendulum, back to the era of antiquity of Ovid and on to the present day, rats have been part of the human story.
They're a bit like people, really. You know, they take advantage of the resources around them.
In fact, they've been vital to our own self-knowledge. Scientists have preferred lab rats more than most any other animal in studies to better understand human behavior. And yet, what do we really know about rats? Did you know, for starters, they feel empathy? In one study, rats passed up chocolate to save drowning pals. Chocolate. But despite their complex nature, many of us just think pests.
I don't know that we'll ever be able to consider rats in their own being. I mean, I think that it's like this fight to the death with rats. And they seem to be, you know, different from so many other animals in that regard.
So how's our battle with rats going? Not so good. Despite centuries of attempts to destroy them, rats are not going anywhere. And nearly half of all mammals are rodents, many being rats.
You know, we mentioned the unexplained Australian plague of rodents.
We
not
did?
Too long ago on the
yes.
show, didn't we?
On the roads.
On this side.
I was not responsible.
All right, well,
I was only following orders.
I was only following rodents. You know what I ended up?
Yeah?
Brisbane.
I was following rodents and I ended up in your driveway.
No, no.
It was a foggy night.
I was reading the rodents,
I think you're the little schumpfer.
Don't. Oh, on Australian radio.
Was it the right word?
Schlinker.
We'll have to look it up.
I was following the lemmings and I went surfing.
Lemmings, that's the word. It's him.
Now,
von Lemming, right?
Rodent specialist in the United States. This is more news on it from Science News, March 21st.
That's a magazine you can buy magnets from.
That's right. Oh, and all sorts of wonderful things. Rodent specialists are puzzled. The outbreak calls to mind the Appalachian squirrel eruption in the fall of 1968, when an estimated 20 million
There's
gray squirrels
coming out of the air, Mommy.
Left their home territories and moved
all
in
dead.
All directions.
Like a fish.
In rain? Fish and squirrels.
In a desperate search
Would
for new
like
jobs.
Fish and squirrels with or without the plum sauce?
How about a fish and squirrel sandwich?
How about plum? Because this one just fell out of the sky. Would you like it pitted?
Oh, here's another one.
Or paired.
Pear.
But a mammal
pear
ecologist.
Take two at a time.
But a mammal ecologist who has published a study of that event, Dr.
A mammal ecologist?
That's what it says.
That's what they look like. Oh, Phil. All right,
what?
Go ahead. No, go ahead.
He has a twitchy nose.
Dr. Van Fligger of the University
wait a minute.
Of...
Why don't you look that up?
Why don't you look Fligger
oh, yeah,
up, right?
I think he's all right, though. I
Fligger
don't think
is what
he's
we
one
used
one
to
us.
Call the... in Africa.
Go ahead. No, go ahead.
All right.
All right.
Okay.
You have to check so many things out.
All right. The Victorian mouse outbreak seems to have been much more intense. I just don't have any idea what could be the cause of such a thing, he says. A squirrel migration wasn't anything compared to this mouse plague. The squirrel migration was triggered by a poor crop of acorns, right?
Boom! Missed again! Three more squirrels.
Dr. Frank A. Petelka, a research ecologist in the Museum of Vertebrate Zoology at the University of California at Berkeley, is also mystified by the mouse outbreak.
No, he's mystified by a drug he took yesterday. The mouse outbreak is only tangential.
He took some mousadrine.
He's been scampering around the laboratory for 48 hours, having visions of human beings on mouse back.
What puzzles him is that the rodents most commonly subject to population eruptions, such as the lemming, an Arctic mouse, belonging to the rodent subfamily Microtinae.
Microbopae.
Microbopae, right.
Microbopae. First of all, it isn't...
Mini-bopae and microbopae.
It's not a mouse eruption. It's a Maoist eruption in Australia. That's why they're so...
political.
Man, there are Maoists all
it.
Over the road, man.
There's a sign in the Star News building next door. There's a big picture of a mouse with a graduation hat on. It says... Send a mouse to college.
American. Yeah, it does.
Do you know?
Outside.
Remember how I was screaming in the studio
rats.
About how the colleges are just torture chambers? And that's one of the reasons that people are, like, leaving them because, like, inside the middle of the university are just people tearing open mouses' heads and putting electrodes. There in the bank, right next door here, there's a picture of a mouse with a letter sweater on.
It's
Star News.
Paper.
Do you see it?
Paper.
With a letter sweater on. It says American Cancer Society. And it says, he's holding a poster. It says, send a mouse to college.
Ideas contributor Moira Donovan explores these fascinating creatures in our two-part series, Rats. Today, part one, Haunting Humanity's Footsteps.
The point is, in the early modern period, people tried everything to get rid of rats.
Every castle, every community had a priest, but also a rat catcher. And this rat catcher was a kind of, I don't know, semi-mystical figure, like a vermin whisperer.
In fact, sometimes the priest was a kind of rat catcher.
And they would perform exorcisms, basically, or curses. I mean, this was as late as the 17th century, as that people would get together and a priest would, you know, curse the animals, including the rats, and bid them leave from this field or these waters or these pastures. And that was regarded as a kind of a trial.
Rats.
Speak, Father Dolan. Go ahead. Tell the folks the Christmas message.
Let the defrocked father speak.
Go ahead, Father.
Well, as Billy Graham said, Chairman Mao was quoted as saying that a revolution is something which must not only call for belief, but must be experienced.
I'm glad you mentioned Billy Graham, because you know what else he said? He said we had rats in our day, too. The only difference was we killed our own rats, and the government didn't do it for us. That's what he said.
Well, you know, the rat population, you know, was being considered an endangered species by the Small Animal Administration.
Administration, yes. I know.
The reason being is that rats used to die in the millions, as you know, Doctor, from overdosing on marijuana and warfarin and, things
those
like that.
Those were only the wharf rats that... Warfarin were involved rats, with the warfarin scandal.
Poor pathetic little creatures, yes. Falling over.
Well, on welfare.
I know. Walking those ropes.
Welfare rats are very high, yes. Now.
In transgressing boundaries, rats resembled another group persecuted at this time. Tens of thousands of people, mostly women, were put on trial as witches in the early modern period. And these persecutions were often interwoven with fears about rats.
Some historians have argued that the greatest number of prosecutions of witches occurred in England during the years 1587 and 1588. And those were also the years of great, you know, losses of food supplies. And those were also years in which rats came in from a number of prosecutions. That kind of proximity doesn't necessarily imply any causality, but it's clear that these things happening together, you know, created a kind of, I don't know, a lethal, you know, mix of misfortunes.
So rats and witches were blamed for food shortages and threatening the very survival of the community. Both were associated with miasma, or bad air, the early modern explanation for the spread of disease. And in fact, it was believed that witches could turn into rats.
Ulrich had no sooner lowered his glance than he witnessed the sudden transformation of Professor Archer into a large silver crow. They both turned into crows. Each lifted his wings in surprise and rose like a shout, leaving the little town of Kyoto and its bewildered populace 500 feet below, silent specks on the vast western desert floor. Unable to speak to one another, but pursuing the same course, they soared like brothers all that day and perhaps another, floating on each other's thoughts, never moving their wings, yet journeying a great distance to the sun.
Down, dear sun, a river of buffalo drinking from a hidden spring. Can you see?
Inexplicably with an ancient cockroach in a sombrero they knew instantly to be Don Brewer.
Follow this snake,
he said.
Follow this snake. This snake is a river,
he said. And they jumped on the snake and rode it hard like a bronco where the snake was swallowed by the sea. And they looked in a direction they had never looked before. They saw a city of gold and amber and crystal in the sky at the bottom of the sea. And at the gate of that city, a white buffalo was grazing, and raising its great head, met their gaze directly.
So it's probably not a huge surprise that in the whole literature discourse surrounding witches' familiars, that rats were one of the animals whose bodies, whose shape witches were thought to be able to assume. And that's where we get at the beginning of this kind of Halloween imagery of rats and witches. But it turns out to be a much more, you know, complicated problem than that imagery would imply. And this is where I think the relationship between rats and witches gets very interesting. Witches could assume the form of these small animals only by virtue of these theories of miasma that were thought to be responsible for disease. Okay, so again, there wasn't a sense of, you know, a notion of germ theory as we know it, but there was a sense that what they called bad air was associated with disease. Animals of putrefaction, like rats and also toads and other things, were associated with theories of bad air. Witches weren't able to transform, it was thought, into anything. I mean, they couldn't assume, you know, the let's say a horse. They could rarely become a horse, but that they could easily transform into these small creatures like toads and salamanders and rats by virtue of what was called inspissated air. And that is air characterized by vapors, you know, heavy, heavy air in which creatures of putrefaction lived.
It's been very, bummer, man. It's been very clear in Los Angeles, so you get a chance to see it. And so I've gotten a wonderful perspective from my Zeppelin, just looking down at the town and everything like that. Good chance to see the old earth, because when the smog moves back in, you see, the feeling I have, what's going to happen is that the smog will move in during the summer, and one fall it'll get blown away by the big winds, and there'll be a different thing there, an entirely different thing, right? A new city, right?
Or the smog has its own alchemy. It'll change it.
That's right.
It'll just change it.
I understand that if the smog and the heat are combined just right, it'll cook the whole city.
Really?
Oh. Yeah, that's
well, that'll be
say.
Tasty eating, Bob, for us trolls.
Yum, yum.
Stop paying trolls. We come out from under the freeway bridge. It's where we live.
Hey, the whole place will be spinning like a great Colonel Palmer song, whatever is the name of those people.
Colonel Human.
Colonel Human.
Human barbecue.
Orange is the color of my tree.
Is it my time to be on the show yet?
All right.
You're getting into my subject area there.
We're getting into your voices.
Yeah.
All right, boys. All right, mateys. Quiet down.
So this, you know, this easy association between rats and disease or rats and witches that we now see in the Halloween imagery was much, much more complicated and enabled by these theories of bad air.
This connection between rats and witches is on display in Act One of Shakespeare's Macbeth. The three weird sisters are catching up before Macbeth arrives on the scene, with one cackling about pursuing a married sailor. On a side note, while it was believed witches could turn into rats, it was an imperfect transformation, as they'd be missing a tail.
I've always been fascinated by in Macbeth is just this, you know, one image of the witch. She's gone to the sailor. You could probably quote that passage if you wanted to.
A sailor's wife had chestnuts in her lap and munched and munched and munched. Give me, quoth I. Arrant thee, witch, the rump-fed Ronian cries. Her husband's to Aleppo gone, master the tiger, but in a sieve I'll thither sail, and like a rat without a tail.
And she says to him, you know, I'll do.
I'll do.
Come cooking, cousin, stout the pate, boil the oil and bait the meat.
I've deep fried fowl, a bucket load.
This fowl is fair.
It's laced with toad.
Add spleen of banker, hand of cock, tongue of lawyer, dearly bought.
Wing of condor, whoop of crane, dolphin's throat and sperm whale brain.
Raw must say, then boil like lava, whilst we take five for Mocha Java.
It wasn't just that witches were thought to be able to turn into tailless rats. In Macbeth and in early modern thought, rats and witches were metaphorically linked through their connection to sexual perversity.
On the one hand, there was a classical tradition from Ovid that rats had, you know, were creatures, what were called creatures of putrefaction. That is, they just sort of sprang spontaneously out of dirt and mud. And that tradition is still alive to some extent, even, you know, by the end of the 17th century in some circles. But it was complicated by a lot of work that had been done in science, which really just directly contradicted that. And what you see in the treatises is a lot of hedging of bets that people are often unwilling to come down on one side or another of that point of view. But what they did all agree on is that rats reproduced so quickly that it was not a real stretch of imagination as to see them as being spontaneously generated. They couldn't really understand how these, you know, these creatures showed up in such great and devastating numbers and so quickly. I mean, a sexuality that reproduced so rapidly and turned two creatures into a swarm, often in, you know, in a month, then that was going to be a source of threat to the agricultural order. But I think symbolically, it was also perceived as threatening. And you can look at some of the literature and see the ways in which rats were associated with often a kind of disgusting promiscuity. Sometimes they were associated with cannibalism.
The dizzy display of instinctive primitive appetites
as the cannibals and the animals eat each other in ring number four.
Nor can we let the cameras reveal
the shameless shenanigans of Duar and McDonald, the Irish explorers.
Former mailmen, now all mailmen. You can't see them as they meet in ring number two.
The black holes, sinless sisters from inner space.
Men disappear into them.
They disappear into themselves.
It's magic.
Cirque International.
And in ring number five. Forget it. Only the living will be able to see.
The daring Hintons, a liberated middle-class family performing dangerous acts of love with unpredictable stimuli and stimulants.
Reunited at last with Bruto and Crasher. Each German police dog trained to sniff marijuana, now with their warm noses in another bush.
Rats didn't cause the plague. The flea caused the plague. The flea is the whole point.
Just give him the flea.
No, not that one. There it is. Xenopsylla chiapus, the rat flea. See, this guy here gave the plague to this guy here, a rat. Killing the rat. Once the flea senses the cold dead rat, it prefers to find a warm live rat. But if a human happens to come along...
You've got the plague. Well, isn't he a good sport? We'll be back in just a moment with our next patient, but first...
From 1347 to 1352, the plague, or Black Death, killed a third of the population of 14th century Europe. And just as many, if not more, rats.
So what stopped the plague?
No one really knows. Maybe soap, closed sewers, a change in temperature? Or some believe this guy. Rattus norwegicus, the brown rat, better known as the Norway rat.
Hallo and that.
That's us, right?
Right. The Norway rat came from China, and according to mythology, brought the gift of rice to man.
Wait. The Norway rat came from China?
Yes. The rat even holds the place of honor as the first year of the Chinese zodiac, a symbol of good luck, wealth, intelligence, charm, charisma, ambition, adaptability, versatility. Shall I go on?
You're not making any sense. We came from China, but we're called Norway rats?
I'm getting to that. British naturalist John Birkenauer named us Norway rats, believing we had come to England on a Norwegian boat. The silly thing is, the brown rat didn't live in Norway at the time. More than likely, we came from Denmark. But the name just stuck.
Wait, now we're from Denmark?
Let it go.
The world was in the grip of the third plague pandemic, spread by rats.
So the Great Hanoi Rat Hunt happens in 1902, which is really right in the middle of the worst years of the third bubonic plague pandemic. And that pandemic starts as an epidemic in Yunnan in the 1850s and then spreads to Canton and Hong Kong in the 1890s. And that's when the world takes note. It really becomes a pandemic, meaning it's connecting different continents in the 1890s. And the reason that this disease became a pandemic was because of this newly industrialized system of maritime transportation. Steamships moving so quickly and against the wind dramatically shortened shipping times around the world.
The plague would go on to kill 12 million people and fueled, among other things, a wave of anti-Chinese sentiment as people substituted fears about rats from China with mistrust of Chinese people.
So that when plague breaks out in Hong Kong in 1894, it's in cities in India just a few years later. It hits Honolulu in 1899. Honolulu is my hometown, so I know this story well. And one of the things the white government did, American allied white government, is they set fire to Chinatown and they burned down Honolulu's Chinatown as a way to stop the disease. In 1900, the disease makes it to San Francisco. So in San Francisco, the authorities quarantine Chinatown and don't let Chinese in or out of this neighborhood. And they actually talk about a, quote, Honolulu solution of burning down San Francisco's Chinatown, just like Chinatown was burnt down in Honolulu. And the rats make it to Australia, for example. And there's bounties put out for rats in Australia. And throughout the discourse in the West, it's tied to Sinophobia. It's tied to this fear and hatred of Chinese.
Well, you know, as they say down south, the symbol of firmness symbolizes heaven.
You can't say that on the radio. Though,
wait a minute. I never heard that. Sure. The symbol of firmness. What? That's what they say. Oh, yeah, my old daddy used to say that. I remember that, sure.
Mao's daddy used to say that?
Mao's daddy used to say that, sure, yeah.
What translation?
When we was marching from Memphis, you know, to Mobile in the People's Revolutionary March 8th Pornography Strike Force.
That's Mao Bill.
Yeah, Mao Bill. Mao Bill, right.
You're part of the old shock troops. You used to run into people's houses and go, bunga, 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 ah! What a shock, boy. Yeah. They'd believe anything after that.
Stuck outside of Memphis with the Mao Bill blues again. That's right.
You know, the Peking Opera came to Mobile, you know. The Mobile People's Opera, the one on wheels.
The Peking
now.
Toms, that's what they call them.
That's right, they used to look in, and what they do is they come, it's a four-hour opera, and all the conservatives come to watch it, you know, and they fall asleep, and then communists come in and tie them up and take them off to jail.
So that, the Peking Opera, isn't that 500,000 people standing in an open field all singing the same song, almost?
Almost. That's the vacant lot where the Atomic Cafe
that's
sprang
right.
up.
That's
they
right.
planted a gas station.
I like to build a world of coke and sniff it every day. I like to build a world.
International cooperation, folks.
We gathered these millions of Italian drug addicts on this hilltop in China.
And if you and can made read this printing,
Joe got a good eyes, Joe.
Yeah, don't drop the bombs on the WAPA drug addicts. They belong to the Japanese Peace Council.
With a drink like this, who needs hair? The symbol of firmness symbolizes heaven. Yeah, I think my daddy did say that.
Mountain summit stone.
And this is a pattern that, well, is still with us 120 years later with Trump's unfortunate and really racist use of the term Kung Flu and other racist terms regarding the COVID-19 pandemic. And, you know, one thing that's just a reality of epidemiology is that a number of diseases do originate in China and can become epidemic and pandemic. And that has everything to do with Chinese demography. Large population density, people living in relatively close proximity to ducks and chickens and pigs, migration patterns of wild birds from central and southern China up to Siberia, where various diseases are endemic in local ponds and wetlands that these migratory birds go to, and they bring them back to southern China, where they can jump into domesticated animal populations and then can be passed on to humans. I mean, this is just basic disease ecology.
And now, a pause in the busy day's activity. As the doctor leaves his little rectumry, walks out the marble path covered with aggies, cat's eyes from his youth, down the long path of life, past the elm grove of superstition, and toward the true way. Yes, it's Dr. Whiplash. He's come again to the font of perpetual resurrection to answer some of your questions. Dave, what's the first question?
Well, I have a letter here from a gentleman in Flotsam's Mistake, New Jersey. And actually, he's been kind enough to send this letter in on a tape cassette for you, Doctor, so we'll hear his voice and you can use his voice to help you analyze the problem.
It's a novel idea. Leave it to the Japs.
Dear Dr. Whiplash, I am a Japanese businessman. Why have I written before? So I still suffering from the same complaint. I only suffer in the office during the day. At night, I eat out and feel better. And although I can't sleep, it's because of apartment noise. What should I do? Hideo Gump.
Dear Hideo, your symptoms are shared by people other than your race. To wit, many executives complain to me as suffering from flushing, blushing, running of the mouth, high stool, seat cramps, delayed borgorygmus, and shortness of pants. They also, like you, feel relieved of these symptoms away from the orifice. Can anything be done? Yes. And it should be done now. They, and you, Hideo, are suffering from farmer's lung, usually confined to barns and sponge warehouses. It is attributable to a hybrid fungus, which lodges in the massive air conditioning systems that supply oxygen of sorts to the big buildings that your daddy works in. Although the same bug can be found in home furnaces, it's often rendered ineffectual due to the fact that poor people can't afford air conditioning and are forced to run their furnaces to heat their homes during the summer. This fries the fungus. We doctor people use the word microsporifera funi in referring to this little pest, and literally it can be translated as funny spores, long known as the cause of Theodore's disease, running sores in athletes' feet. Recently, this microscopic troublemaker has also been blamed in the nasty disease labeled Hartman's palsy, formerly Strassman syndrome, the only cure for which is death. I'll answer any questions, dear friends. Just write me if you still have the strength. Until next week, this is Dr. Whiplash. I'm out for lunch.
And China, in many ways, is this perfect storm just because of demographics and geography. What we see with the third bubonic plague pandemic and what we see today with COVID-19 and racist xenophobic responses there is sort of a willful ignorance of the realities of how diseases move, and in turn a blaming of China and Chinese and associating Chinese bodies with disease, which I think fits into a larger discourse of anti-Chinese racism, of yellow peril discourse, and really a lot of the anxiety that the West felt towards China in the era of high imperialism, after the Opium Wars, after the violence of repressing the Boxer Rebellion and so forth.
Box of time.
We buy what you want.
Box to put it in.
We buy what you won't touch.
There's a lot of anxiety about China. And again, disease gets tied into that anxiety.
Rats aren't the only animal that can incite these anxieties by spreading disease. But as we'll explore in part two, they are essential to our understanding of how animals spread disease. and is one of our most constant companions, they have an important role to play.
Welcome to Ideas. I'm Nahla Ayed. Today, part two in our series on rats, an animal whose omnipresent existence is largely because of us.
Rats really are one of the invasive species most tied to human movement.
And the global rat population, again thanks to us, is soaring. They can now be found in almost every corner of the earth.
I think that they really are our sibling animal right now.
This is my brother Emil.
Hi.
We're here to speak out on behalf of oppressed rats everywhere.
Oh,
rats who
man.
Don't have the access to media that our movie
We're
affords
speaking
us.
Out.
Yes, we have to. We rats need to take a stand.
You said we'd sing something, you know, joke around. You did not say we were going to take a stand.
This is important. Humans need to know. Humans need to
feed us. That's what you need to do. Leave some garbage out and we won't bother you. Just leave the lid on top of the can loose.
All right, moving on. This is a man.
Hello.
A dog, man's best friend, looks up to man. A cat looks down on man. We rats see ourselves as equal to man, but you humans don't seem to see it that way.
It's ours again! I've got it! I'm coming home! Oh, brother rat!
Stop that little squealer!
Rodents, including rats, make up nearly half of all mammals on Earth.
I was looking at some stats on rat demographics recently, and the rise in the rat population over the 19th and 20th century is tied to the rise in human population. And they increase at roughly the same, because as we make more people and build bigger cities, we create more of a habitat for them. And I think that that's just fascinating. Just absolutely fascinating.
And that's not the only thing fascinating about these creatures. Even though many of us fear rats, remember this cult horror classic.
Joe, this here is Harold the Hawk Lunget and his gang, Willard.
Shall I wipe him off, boss? Shall I drive him around the block? Let me clean his car, boss.
Curb your rat, Hawk.
Don't mind Willard. He's just a psychopathic killer.
This is Willard. And these are his friends.
My God, look at the rats!
I'm gonna clip him, boss. I'll trim his hedge. I'll mow him down.
Go squeeze your tomato, Willard. They're playing your song.
Let me squeeze this one, boss.
Take
just a second, old man.
Just a second, old
it's
man.
It's lady's choice, Ratso.
Thanks, Joe.
But our fear is misplaced. Rats are rarely aggressive towards humans. And for those who study rats, to know them is to admire them.
They are highly enterprising. They are intelligent, as animals go. They are manipulative. You know, they don't quite have the opposable thumb, but they have a lot of what it takes.
Rats' noses can sniff out tuberculosis and landmines with greater accuracy than human technology.
Catherwood?
Yes, madam.
Catherwood. Oh, you startled me.
I'm sorry, madam.
What are you doing there on all fours?
I'm looking for my script. Why don't you just go on without me?
Listen, Mansi, I smell a rat.
So do I. I think he's got my script.
Oh, yes, Catherwood, you look for it, all right?
All right, you. Madam.
And their survival skills are second to none. They can gnaw through cinder blocks, tread water for 3 days straight, and squeeze through a hole the size of a quarter. In laboratories and in the alleys and sewers of our cities, rats have a lot to teach us about what it takes to make it in this world.
That has been humbling to me, that I can look to a rat for wisdom. And I'm not saying that to be, you know, cute or anything.
Behavioral neuroscientist Kelly Lambert.
Really, they are teaching me about what brains respond to and how you always need to be vigilant about what's going on in the environment around you to make the most adaptive responses. Because if something changes in the environment that is incredibly important to our survival and our well-being, we're likely to miss it if we're not being attentive and present.
Researchers say that in order to control rats, as our cities grow, our world warms, and our garbage piles higher, we need to consider rats as animals in their own right and to try to see the world from their perspective.
You have to think, it's, what would a rat do? You have to think like that to study it and to try to manage these populations.
And while rats can spread disease to humans, their role in laboratory studies has dramatically improved our health, both physically and mentally.
Rats, then, we owe our respect to that mammal. We actually do owe great thanks to this group of mammals, Rattus and Mus, the mouse, those two. You and I here as human beings, you owe a tremendous amount of thanks to these animals that we've used to benefit our lifespans, our health, because we've studied these animals extensively. So they're actually the most important mammal group to Homo sapiens than any other mammal group. But the irony is, you know, most people make a face when you say rats, when they should say, yep, you know, we owe a lot of thanks to those mammals. We are so much better because of those mammals. But yet, we dismiss them.
Ideas contributor Moira Donovan brings us the second and final part in our series on rats. It explores the contributions rats have made to humanity and strategies for a more peaceful coexistence.
Take Corrigan's experience when in graduate school, he moved into barns to study rat colonies.
And I slept on the floor with them for weeks and so I could learn as a PhD student how they behave and what they do. In general, rats try to avoid us as much as possible. We're big. We're a big predator. We can kick them. We can hurt them. And we do all kinds of things to them.
And welcome back to the 35th annual Jerry Ford Palm Springs Desert Golf Rat Shoot. Well, the big surprise today as we look up there at the leaderboard is the sudden surge of presidential candidates among the front runners in the celebrity ranks. For a report on this phenomenon, at the ninth tee is Jack Rodenticus. Jack?
At the ninth tee with Ted Kennedy, sporting that thin mustache transplant, which I think makes him look very much like David Niven. His partner, Lee Trevino, just hit a very beautiful wood shot to the green, and now Kennedy is bending over the ball. There's that preppy backswing of his, so distinct.
The shot's hooking! Oh, over the bridge and into the water! That's really a bad stroke for Mr. Kennedy. He's in trouble now. He'll have to dive for that ball. And he's talking it over with family and friends. He's waving his hand, waving away the advice of a lawyer. It looks like, yes, he will dive for the ball now and call the police in the morning. Ed?
Well, indications right here in the clubhouse are that this could eliminate Kennedy from the hunt. But let's go to Sam Norvegicus at the 16.
Ed, a really big rat has just poked his head out of the tumbleweed just 3 feet from where Ronald Reagan's chip shot lies for a very possible birdie here on the ultra-tough 16th. Reagan has called for a double O-gauge shotgun. That's the one he used in the deadly desert MGM 1939, but it's a rather unusual choice here on the 16th. Most pros would have gone after that rat with a knife, but of course Reagan's been in this tournament before and looks like he overshot with that and wounded his caddy, California Lieutenant Governor Mike Kerb, who was bending over to pick up the ball. That must be painful, and it's going to be tough on the rulemakers here because I don't remember this ever happening before. Of course, lately I don't seem to remember anything, Ed?
Well, you're right, Sam. Nothing like that has ever happened before, and Breen Prance that the rat was... No, wait a minute. Let's just go down to Bill Sumatra there on the 17th.
President Jimmy Carter trying to take his tee shot, and he'll have to take it on a dogleg right. This is the first time the president has set foot outside the White House since the many international crises that have dominated his attention. Except, of course, for those short, supervised, well-publicized trips to the bathroom. He's not going to play the shot? That is right. He's walking away from the tee. Must know something we do. Would you look at that? What a gorgeous move. He's smashed a rat flat that was hiding just behind a spectator. Smashed it flat.
Excuse me for interrupting, but back here on the ninth, Kennedy just shot an eagle.
Oh, well, that'll get him in trouble with environmentalists.
Yeah, but he used a fully automatic AR-14 on it.
That should be good with the NRA.
Definitely. I think so. So he's gentlemen, lost,
excuse me, gentlemen, let's go down to Ben Bland on the 19th.
Ed, it's really bad here.
those six rats that Jerry Brown wouldn't kill, and they got out of his three-piece suit, and look at that, they're taking over the best seats of the bar, and they're telling all of Ronnie Reagan's jokes in advance. This could really surprise.
Sorry to cut in, Ben, but that's all the time we have now. We'll be back tomorrow for the final round of the Jerry Ford Palm Springs Desert Golf Rat Shoot. But now let's join Jim McKay at the disgruntled alternate Olympic site in Boston, Massachusetts.
So in general, they try to stay away from us. I personally have never, ever been attacked by rats. Never. And I've put myself right in the thick of those animals, as thick as I can get, including when I was an exterminator saving money for college. I worked in sewers, and I had rats all around me in sewers. Never once did they attack me down in the sewers.
I can't come that way. My knees are tied together.
Oh, now your gag's falling out again. I don't know about that Willard. He doesn't know any good knots. Then I don't know any good gags.
Where the hell are we? In hell?
Hell? No, Mr. Atkins, we're right under your house, what? Near your nightclub.
Then these are my sewers.
That's enough now, Turkey. You're on the short end of the fuse of doom. The electrician's gonna pull your plug.
As a young man, Corrigan had no intention to study rats.
I thought I was going to be Jacques Cousteau. That's what I started out to do, is I wanted to fall off boats and swim with the whales. But I had no money going to college, so I answered an ad in the newspaper to be an exterminator in New York City. And sure enough, where did I end up? Sewers. I ended up in sewers, killing rats in sewers.
Follow me, boss. Follow me. My nose.
Yeah, I see. It's glowing, see?
I smell a rat.
Yeah, Joe from Chicago, see? Taking over my sewer, see?
I see. Oh, I'll find him, boss. I'll come through the walls. I'll squeak in the night. Hold
on the floor. And on one hand, I'll never forget, I thought, this is a horrible job. This is ridiculous. What are you doing? And my parents and everybody like, what kind of a job did you take? You're climbing into sewers to kill rats. This is disgusting. But after a while, I started looking and I said, you know what? I see a lot of intelligence down here in the sewers. I see rats swapping information with each other. I see the way they went.
The world we live in belongs to the enemy. We must live carefully. We look out for our own kind, Remy. When all is said and done, we're all we've got.
No.
What?
No. Dad, I don't believe it. You're telling me that the future is, can only be, more of this?
This is the way things are. You can't change nature.
Change is nature, Dad. The part that we can influence. And it starts when we decide.
Where are you going?
With luck, forward.
And the more I read, the more I studied, and I kind of fell in love with, like, listen, this is really cool. I don't care what anyone thinks. And from there, in graduate school, I just said, I want to study rats and as a pest. And I had a great advisor that said, if that's what you want to do, passion is going to drive your studies, you should do it.
People in Victorian times, say, or early Victorian times, up until the 1890s, believed that rats are exceptionally free from diseases. And not only that, but that they were really good as kind of ways of cleansing sewers from disease. That's what people believed at the time. So not only were they not associated with plague or other diseases, but they were believed to be kind of good for public health.
But where rats might be most useful is the light they shed on the human brain.
I'm Kelly Lambert, and I'm a behavioral neuroscientist at the University of Richmond in Richmond, Virginia. And I have been working with rodent models, what we call preclinical models, maybe to learn more about biomedical conditions of humans. Been working with rodents for over 3 decades, and I continue to learn from them every day.
Roughly 95% of all lab animals are either rats or mice. As for Lambert, her preferred rodent in the lab? Well, since this documentary is about rats, the answer likely doesn't come as a surprise.
rats engage in more complex cognitive behavioral responses than mice do. So a majority of biomedical research is done on rats and mice, but in the past 20 years, 15, 20 years, it has really, the mice have taken over the rat. So there are a couple of issues there. Research is expensive. Physical space is expensive. Mice are smaller as opposed to rats. They're bigger. They eat more. They poop more. We kind of got on this train of using mice more than rats. But it's important to know your species and to make sure that the species you're using is a representative model of what you're trying to model and understand. So I would absolutely come down on team rat when we're looking at behavioral neuroscience, cognitive complexity, those types of behaviors. A bigger question is, okay, this is a rat, it's not a human. What can we even learn from a rat? And of course, in the book, I write about that.
The book Lambert just referred to is called The Lab Rat Chronicles. A neuroscientist reveals life lessons from the planet's most successful mammals.
Ever since the rats rose, however, to the positions of responsibility within the Bureau, we've had to considerably change our propaganda about rats.
The great filibusterers.
Yes. Have you talked to Director Rat about this lately?
Yes, and I spoke to the assistant chairman, Mr. Rat, also his brother-in-law at the same time, and they definitely wanted us to change the image that rats have been getting.
Well, we're going to retailor the symbol of the Small Animal Administration and get rid of that little puppy doggy and a little pussy catty that we had in the middle of it.
And a little squirrel in the background.
Senator, please don't cry.
Those are all, dated imagery, we say in the office. We're going to put four square, a rat, right in the middle with a map of Brooklyn in back of it to let people really know where the money is going to go.
And where it's coming from, too.
That's true.
Suits for those rats are now $5
and $6. Are we suing the rats? Good God. I've got to get my papers together and go to court. Just a minute.
Well, you know, it all started when, in 1977, duplicate President Noxon gave the rats the vote. That's where it started.
Oh,
right.
It wasn't so bad that he had to start at 18-year-old rats.
That's right. That really got Nixon's monkey up.
And by the time a rat's 18, he's been everywhere. He's been in every major city in this country.
He's been to Europe, Asia, Vietnam, tours of duty on the USS McClintock.
Many rats took off with Bob Hope yesterday at the Burbank Air Force. The National Guard. It stood on either side, you know, a line on either side of the walkway.
A three-gun salute.
Yes, I shot three rats, too, in doing so. Which
it wasn't an accident. It wasn't any accident.
Well, it won't make them any friends in Washington.
Well, it's the only way you can get rid of the little buggers.
Well, you let them get on the plane, and then, you know, they push them out once they get over Vietnam.
They parachute down with all the money they leached from the American government.
We save a few bucks that way. We don't parachute
down. I say give them a separate country. That's what I say is give them a separate country.
Ratland.
Right next to Liberia.
Yeah.
President Abraham Lincoln Tubman Rat.
That's right.
Of Ratland.
And they can go over to Liberia and read and educate themselves. Get better.
They can have a Lindley.
Although a better rat is a frightening idea, you know.
But a frightened rat is twice as dangerous.
Yes, how are we going to possibly keep them frightened? Africans are afraid of nothing, you know.
I'm having trouble keeping a woman. Keeping millions of rats is going to be an incredible problem for a man like myself.
They already have super rats because they've been eating the poison for so many years they've become addicted to it.
And so have I.
On a general level, they have all the same brain parts that we have. It's just a very scaled down. Our brain is about 1,400 grams. Their brain is 2 grams, but it has a cerebrum and a cerebellum and a brainstem and a hippocampus. If you look at a neuron, a brain cell in a rat under a microscope, and a brain cell neuron in a human, you can't tell the difference. It has all the same structure. They use the same neurochemicals. It's a very good scaled down model of a mammalian brain. We're still dealing with drug models that were introduced 50 years ago, that the efficacy rates are disappointingly low. We need to do better. And if we're going to invest all of our research dollars and time into these animals, we need to make sure the environment is representative of an environment for these animals so that we can truly, we don't want to measure lung output or function by looking at rats or lungs that are exposed to low oxygen environments because they don't have the fuel and the nutrients that it needs to function normally. Experience is the fuel, in addition to glucose and oxygen, for brains.
Our current theory of addiction comes in part from a series of experiments that were carried out earlier in the 20th century. The experiment is simple. You take a rat and put it in a cage with two water bottles. One is just water, the other is water laced with heroin or cocaine. Almost every time you run this experiment, the rat will become obsessed with the drugged water and keep coming back for more and more until it kills itself. But in the 1970s, Bruce Alexander, a professor of psychology, noticed something odd about this experiment. The rat is put in the cage all alone. It has nothing to do but take the drugs. What would happen, he wondered, if we tried this differently? So he built Rat Park, which is basically heaven for rats. It's a lush cage where the rats would have colored balls, tunnels to scamper down, plenty of friends to play with, and they could have loads of sex. Everything a rat about town could want. And they would have the drugged water and the normal water bottles. But here's the fascinating thing. In Rat Park, rats hardly ever use the drugged water. None of them ever use it compulsively. None of them ever overdose.
They don't just develop in a vacuum. Experience molds our brains, just like an artist, you know, does this great piece of sculpture. So we're probably going to have to step up with the way we are housing animals, at least in the biomedical areas related to psychiatric and mental health, if we're going to get representative models that are translatable up to humans, which is the true goal of that research.
Dick, I've got it now. I know I've got it.
You got what? Don't come near me.
Gosh, I've got the secret of power.
Well, that's great. What is it, Tom?
Rats. I got these rats out of the voting booth in my grandmother's kitchen and put them inside this rotating cylinder. Look at them throw up, Dick.
Oh, that sure is something, Tom. Well, what are you going to invent now?
I don't know. Something to plug them into.
You know, Tom, someday these rats are going to run everything.
Okay. Can I have another?
No, let's try one cocktail. Happy New Year, Riddle Rat. How I wonder, where you at? Flying in a plane, you sing like a sparrow in a Peking.